comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Zoo Theater Company, the people who brought you Ain't Misbehavin', presenting Stephen Schwartz's Godspell, December 10th, 11th, and 12th at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Showtimes are 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, with 2:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday matinees. Tickets available at the Virginia Theater box office, 356-9063.
Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Mrs. Foro Archer in memory of her husband, William Archer.
Good morning and welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and glad to have you listening. Producing this program is Harriet Williamson along with Martha Deal and at the controls, Henry Frayne. In this hour of the show, the second hour of the program, we'll be talking about the relationship between the United States and Latin America. And our guest for the program is Ron Scheman. He recently stepped down as the Director General of the Inter-American Agency for Cooperation and Development. He's authored a number of books on inter-American affairs, including one that we'll be talking about this morning. The title is Greater America, A New Partnership for the Americas in the 21st Century. The book is published by New York University Press. And in the book, he makes the argument that the United States is at a crossroads in the intense competition of the global economy. And he says, for this reason, it is very important that the United States come to the aid of its neighbors, working to reverse the current economic stagnation of Latin America. In the book, he argues that the 21st century will either be the century of the Americas together, or it will become the century where China emerges as a world trade power alone. We'll explore more of the argument in this part of the show and, of course, invite people who have questions and comments to call. Let me tell you a little bit more about the background of our guest. In addition to the position that I mentioned, he was from 1993 until 1998 the U.S. Executive Director of the Inter-American Development Bank. In the 60s, he became a founding director of the Center for Advanced Studies of the Americas and the first executive director of the Pan-American Development Foundation, where he led the foundation's pioneering microfinance programs. And again, as I mentioned, he just recently stepped down as Director General of the Inter-American Agency for Cooperation and Development. That is the development agency of the Organization of American States. Questions are welcome. We just ask people who are calling in to try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many calls as possible and keep the program moving. But of course, anybody who's listening is welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have toll-free line, and so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Scheman, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me to be with you.
In the book, you start out saying that in basic ways that historically American foreign policy has neglected Latin America. Perhaps the question to start with is why? Not only that, but why is it that Latin America is important? Why does Latin America matter to the United States?
Well, those are two very good questions. Fundamentally, in this before the 20th century, Latin America, you know, was almost wealthier than the U.S. until the Industrial Revolution came about, from all of the wealth of their minerals and the raw materials. In the 20th century, when we began to emerge as a world power, we became concerned with direct physical threats to our security, and Latin America didn't pose any threat to us. This continued, you know, right up until very recently. During the First World War, Second World War, our concerns in Europe, the threats of the ideologies of fascism, communism, etc., that was the main focus of our foreign policy. So Latin America was pretty well identified by Henry Kissinger's comment that it was, and in the global strategic framework, it was a giant dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica. But there was no real threat. And Latin America has been relatively peaceful so far as global politics is concerned. And for that reason, we have paid very little attention. But the world has changed, and the economies of Latin America today and the global economic competition give Latin America a very different role, and that's what I really discuss in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, before somebody who is listening can call in and ask the question, I guess I will go ahead and pose it and get your reaction. I think that there are some people who would argue that far from being neglected by American foreign policy, that Latin America has suffered as a result of American foreign policy that has supported non-democratic repressive regimes with bad human rights records in countries where the elites have managed to find ways to enrich themselves at the expense of just about everybody else. And that it's a story that has been repeated in a number of places around Latin America, particularly in Central America. True? Not true?
Absolutely true, but it's a little different twist. Those are opposite sides of the same coin. It's been ignored by our senior policy people and ignored in our senior global efforts to really protect United States security. And that has left the Latin American policy, and if you follow it through the 19th century especially, and then up in the early part of the 20th century, you have, a lot of, in the business community, the fly-by-nights, a lot of people who were equally corrupt as the Latin Americans. It wasn't getting the attention, serious attention, from our foreign policy people. And that left the way open to a lot of people who took advantage of the Latin Americans, colluded in corruption, and worked along with dictatorships. Unfortunately, in the 1930s and 40s, we then began to be concerned about maintaining the status quo in Latin America when we began to pay attention. That was really to block the spread of fascism or communism, and Latin Americans suffered the brunt of our, heavy hand in certain circumstances.
Is there anywhere that you can point in the post-war years to any administration, and I guess I'm thinking possibly about the brief time that John Kennedy was president, where you think that the United States was at least moving in the right direction as far as Latin America was concerned?
David, you're not coming through that clear. Could you repeat that question, please?
Yes. What do you feel that there was any administration in the post-war era, and I'm thinking that possibly the Kennedy administration might be one, that you would say was had made moves at least in the right direction as far as Latin America was concerned?
Yeah. No, I didn't hear you before, but now it comes across very clear.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. I divide it into two periods. In the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt adopted the good neighbor policy after a lot of U.S. intervention, that began to move us in the right direction. Then during the Second World War, of course, we were preoccupied with physical threats to our security, and we didn't pay much attention to Latin America, and it was pretty much status quo. After the war, President Kennedy, and this was, of course, after Fidel Castro came to power in Cuba, and there was a lot of concerns about that, but President Kennedy launched the Alliance for Progress, and that was really a major step forward in helping those groups of people within Latin America who believed in democracy and believed in opening up their societies and addressing the social issues. An enormous amount of progress was made in the 1960s in that direction. And I think the witness to that progress was that in 1973, when we had the oil shocks and the petrodollars began to have to be recycled, all of the banks really focused on Latin America and piled their money in. And Latin America was the fastest growing area in the world then. By early 1970s, it was growing at 6-7% a year. And it was really the darling of the financial community far more than Asia. What happened, of course, was Latin America got so piled with debt and so heavily indebted that within about 7 or 8 years, by the early 1980s, they could no longer sustain the debt, especially when interest rates started going through the roof in the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, let me just go to the bottom line and encourage you to talk a little bit about what it is you think the United States should be doing in Latin America. What sort of policy should we have?
Well, our policy in Latin America really has to address the fact that many of our major domestic problems, or real domestic problems today, originate very much in Latin America. And here we're talking about the domestic problems that arise from migration. Latin America is the main source of the people who come to this this country today, of our immigrants, and also the issue of drugs and the danger that can arise from the drug cartels becoming more powerful, corrupting regimes, and undermining democracy. This is a big challenge. The only way out of that challenge is really to create jobs, build education in the hemisphere, education which has been sadly neglected for about, since Latin America began, for 400 years, and to begin to make them more competitive on a global economy so they can earn their own way. This takes a bit of farsighted policy decisions that will help them build their economies to become more competitive and at the same time address the social issues that they have to address. And this is really what we have to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do we do that? Particularly, I'm interested in the aspect of what it is that the United States can do to help these countries develop their economies.
Well, there's not much that we ourselves can do. This is their problem to do that. What we have to do is pay attention and be more sensitive to the issues of opening markets for trade, and then addressing specific issues like when it comes to improving the workplace conditions, the programs, the organizations that are working to do that, improving democracy, strengthening democracy. There are many organizations working on that. I think what you find, David, is that there are clusters of groups in each country that are really working hard to and are strong supporters of democracy, open markets, fair trade. These are the ones that we should be supporting and strengthen their role in their society and not let them get overwhelmed by many vested interests who would like to keep the status quo.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ronald Scheman, and as I mentioned, he just recently stepped down as the Director General of the Inter-American Agency for Cooperation and Development. That's the development agency of the Organization of American States. For a number of years, between 93 and 98, he served as the U.S. Executive Director of the Inter-American Development Bank, and he is the author of a recently published book, which is titled Greater America, A New Partnership for the American in the 21st Century. The book is published by the New York University Press, in which he makes the argument that for the benefit of all of the countries in this hemisphere, not only the United States, but also the countries of Latin America, it's very important for the United States to be involved in the region and to be involved in Latin America, helping those countries to develop their economies, which he says ultimately is going to be very important for the Americas as a competitor in the global market. That's sort of the basic argument, but in much more detail, of course, you will find if you actually look at the book. Questions and comments are welcome to 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, whether you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, or by some chance you might happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Is what you're arguing that ultimately the course for the Americas would be to take what the countries of Europe have done as a kind of a model and that move to taking down barriers for movements of goods and people between the countries, and perhaps even go to the idea, now there, of course there are already countries that are actually using the dollar as their currency or pegging the value of their currencies to the dollar, but actually moving even to the idea of a unified currency for the Americas?
You're touching on some very important issues there, and let me try to take them one at a time. I think free trade, opening trade with Latin America is very much in our interest. Latin America, more than any other area of the world, every dollar that they earn, they spend more of it than any other area of the world here in the U.S. Our almost 40% of our exports now go to Latin America. They spend about 40 or 50 cents of every dollar that they earn here in the U.S. That is double Europe or double what Japan does, which are both in about the 20% in those areas. When you consider that Latin America's per capita income is only about 10-15% of Europe or Latin America or Japan, you can see that Latin America, as their economies grow, this is a prime market for the United States. These people like U.S. products; they buy U.S. products. So it is very much in our interest to build the economies, help the economies grow, and to open up trade with the Americas. There's another factor here that is equally important, is that the methods of inter-American cooperation right now, assuming we can get to free trade, the methods that we have really are not very practical. They're very rhetorical. There's a lot of meetings where people give speeches and talk about ideals. We need more practical ways to deal with each other. And there's what the Europeans set a model many, many years ago. You set them on the path that eventually resulted in the European Union. Whether anything like that is possible in the hemisphere, we don't know at this stage. That's going to be our children's job. But the main thing is that the practical means of working together on issues that are of concern was what began Europe on that path, and that was the European Coal and Steel Community back in the right after the war in the late 40s and 1950s. We have the same opportunity here in the Americas in energy. President Bush has been talking about making the United States energy independent. Well, the United States can't become energy independent alone unless we're dealing with new technologies. But we can become independent, energy independent, if we work with all of the Americas. And therefore, something like an American energy community or an inter-American energy community, whereby we were pooling our resources on energy, would help Latin America develop their energy resources, which are ample, and far more if you can include the heavy oil in Venezuela, Peru, Canada. If we can find economic ways to bring this heavy oil into production, and the gas, enormous gas resources that have been now recently discovered east of the Andes, we can build an energy community and achieve energy independence in the Americas. But more important, we are creating a practical way where we're working together for tangible goals, and that can launch us on a way of really understanding each other better and working together without the rhetoric, but with the actual practical, pragmatic achievements.
So you would support the idea that has been advanced, I think, by the president and by others, that we should move toward creating a free trade zone for the Americas, perhaps something like the North American Free Trade Agreement that has included the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and extending that to all of the Americas?
Yes, I support that very strongly, and that dates back to the first President Bush, President Clinton, and the current president have all been in favor of that. It's been a bipartisan goal for American policy now for almost 15 years.
In an arrangement like that, it seems difficult to imagine that there ever would be a time when the United States was not the dominant player in the free trade zone. It's likely to continue to be the largest economy, the largest consumer of everything, including energy. How do you construct a network that makes it possible so that even the smallest players have sort of an equal say in policy, and that it's not always what the United States wants that will carry the day?
Well, once you get free trade, it's the market that's going to determine. And those countries that respond and become more competitive, that increase their productivity, that improve their workers' skills. You know, you can't get by in the 21st century on cheap labor. That's not going to work. That's a transition event. The key thing is that we have to, as we open up to free trade, recognize that a free trade agreement is not about trade alone. A free trade agreement is about investment. And it channels investment to those areas because the factories or whatever is built will be able to service the U.S. market as well as the small Latin American markets, the small countries. Costa Rica is a perfect example. Intel has now built a plant down there for chip manufacturing. These kind of things will help build the Latin American economies, help increase their earnings. As they increase their earnings, they will be buying more U.S. goods, not other goods. And we will be able to convince other companies, instead of transferring and instead of working in the Far East or in Korea or in Japan or China, to begin to invest closer to home, where it'll improve the quality of life and therefore help us address the other issues that we mentioned at the beginning of migration and drugs and dealing with all of those issues.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation in Newby community of Belgium. Let's go there on our toll-free line. Line 4, hello.
Good morning, sirs. Mm-hmm. Listening to your conversation, I come up with just a very blatant example of where we're doing something altogether wrong, and that's with Cuba. We seem to have this horrible embargo against Cuba. There's really, for the interest of a small group of people in southern Florida that seem to really have a very great amount of influence in the White House right now. But the rest of the Midwest would love to sell agricultural goods to this place, and they're more than willing to buy it. Oh, why can't we step forward in just that small area?
Well, I agree with you that our policy to Cuba has been very distorted. There are very good reasons why we are not friendly with Cuba. The oppression of human rights, the lack of democracy, these are very important goals, not only for the United States, but for the entire free world, Western Europe as well. So to be able to convince the dictator of Cuba to be able to open up his society is very important. I think the caller is correct in the idea that the embargo has not been very productive. My thought is that if we did not have the embargo, that Fidel Castro would have gone a long time ago. I think the embargo has helped to keep him in power, basically because he's able to use the United States as a whipping boy. If there's more commerce and more people going back and forth, as happened in Russia, where the Russian people began to see and understand what they were missing in the rest of the world, the same thing will happen in Cuba. More tourism that you have, the more commerce that you have, the quicker the society will become an open society, and our policies there have been counterproductive.
It seems, though, just very recent policy with the Bush administration has just tried to alienate the situation even much worse, and obviously the Castro regime has now said that they don't want to use dollars, which doesn't seem very intelligent to me in their way of doing business. But still, it seems though there's this back-and-forth battle they've got going on, and I really can't see where their human rights is really involved. I mean, he doesn't allow people to vote for anybody but himself, but you don't hear about a lot of people being tortured and killed and stuff like you do in other nations in the world, in Cuba. They seem to have a pretty good school system. They seem to have a very good health system, all of which are suffering because of this embargo. It sounds to me like it's just totally counterproductive.
Well, it has been counterproductive on those and other scores, but the human rights situation in Cuba is pretty bad. There are a lot of people who were seeking to have more open elections and talking about human rights. And Castro last year put about 70 people in jail, with really rump trials. The ability for dissent in Cuba does not exist. But beside that, the question is how you achieve democracy, looking in a positive way. How do you move Cuba to democracy and open society? And I believe with you that the only way to do this is to get more people moving down there and more commerce, more interchange. And in this sense, the Bush policies have been counterproductive.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for the call. We'll go next to a caller here on our line number one, I believe, is in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead.
Came in real late, David, and don't really know what you guys are talking about. Just hopped in the car, and, you know, I find this continued assertion that what we're interested in is the, you know, the penetration of democracy and human rights into other countries is being just totally absurd. I mean, the amount of product that this country ships back and forth between China every year really just makes that a ludicrous kind of statement. So I just had to catch you on that one, whoever the guest is today, and suggest that really what we're pushing in this country is the interests of the corporate capital, and that's where things come down, and human rights really doesn't enter into that perspective. So I'll try to keep on listening. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, maybe for the benefit of the listener and anybody else who might have tuned in, let me introduce again our guest, and then he can respond to the point that the caller raised. We're talking this morning with Ron Scheman. He just recently stepped down as the Director General of the Inter-American Agency for Cooperation and Development, that is the development agency of the Organization of American States. From 1993 to 1998, he served as the U.S. Executive Director of the Inter-American Development Bank. In the 60s, he became the founding director of the Center for Advanced Studies of the Americas and the first executive director of the Pan-American Development Foundation, where he led the foundation's pioneering microfinance programs. He's the author of a number of books on inter-American affairs, including one that covers the territory we're talking about here this morning. The title of the book is Greater America, A New Partnership for the Americas in the 21st Century. It is published by the New York University Press, and certainly folks who are listening are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Now, having done that, I don't know, Mr. Scheman, do you want to respond to what the caller had to say?
Yeah, I would be happy to respond. I can't think of a better objective for U.S. foreign policy than dealing with democracy and human rights and helping people around the world to achieve that. Whether we do it consistently or not in this world is another question. But there are three goals in foreign policy. First is security of the country, and that is the most important. Second is democracy and human rights. And third is economic prosperity, maintaining economic prosperity and promoting prosperity that will feed back to our economy. Don't forget, we have 4% of the world's population in the United States, and our economy is growing, and we're very good on technology, but to really grow, we want to get the markets and deal with the markets of the other 96%, which brings us to the other point that the caller made about the commerce and that the commercial interests are paramount. They always have been. Commercial interests are commercial interests that relate to trade and economic growth. In dealing with Cuba, which I presume he was referring to my comments in that regard, in dealing with Cuba, you'll find corporate America is the one that wants to open up Cuba because they're the ones that are really really stand to benefit by the low wages, a highly educated population. You see, and as the other caller mentioned, you see right now an increase of agricultural exports to Cuba. So corporate America wants to deal with Cuba in spite of the human rights. So we have a delicate balance. And in all things in foreign policy, nothing is either clear or simple because there are always different interests that have to be weighed and balanced against each other. And in this case, in the case of Cuba, I think we've come out on the wrong side of the interests of the United States. I think democracy and human rights is an important goal. And I think opening up the commerce is one way to help achieve that.
Well, I guess I did want to raise a question. I suppose we're kind of going around in circles here, though. The question about what we do in our relationship to other governments in the region where we do not see eye to eye with them politically speaking. And certainly there are, for example, the United States and Venezuela. Relations have been strained. There are other countries where they do have different political economic philosophies and relations have been strained. What do we do about that?
Well, you know, that's what democracy is all about. Either you believe in democracy and different people, and you know, different people and different countries will have different views on different issues. What you're talking about, David, is very important because relations have deteriorated quite a bit over the last 2 years between U.S. and Latin America. Venezuela is a very important case in that regard. This is not entirely the U.S. fault. There are different interests in engaged here. But we have pretty well neglected what is taking place in Latin America. If I may, just very quickly, you've had a severe downturn, economic downturn, following the U.S. downturn in the year 2001, 2002, the last few years. And the economic reforms that we pressed so hard were done really to bring jobs. In fact, the president of Brazil, Lula da Silva, stated at the Summit of the Americas earlier this year, he said, "You pressed economic reforms, which were supposed to bring financial stability and create jobs, and have done neither." So there's been a reaction to the economic reforms and the policies that the United States has pressed very hard during the 1990s. The only way out of all of this is going to be economic development. And the key to economic development, you're right, we go around in circles. The key to economic development in Latin America is opening trade because their own markets are too small to attract the kind of investment needed to create the jobs that will do this, that will achieve our goals.
Mm-hmm. We touched on this briefly earlier, but I guess I am still curious about the currency sort of issue, just because the United States has been making some record lows lately against other currencies, has been beaten up pretty badly against the euro. If we could do what it is that you're talking about doing, would that affect the value of the dollar? Would that be good for the dollar?
I don't think it would have much impact on the dollar in itself. Basically, the weakening of the dollar has been a very great benefit to Latin America because their currencies are tied to the dollar and fluctuate with the dollar, so their exports have become cheaper. And this year, Latin America has begun a very minor but a very positive economic turn. Their commodity prices globally are going up, and that has benefited them a great deal. Their agricultural exports are going up. So this has been a good year for Latin America. The issue of the currency goes to a broader issue in that when we have an economic downturn in our country, what do? We lower the interest rates, we stimulate the economy, and we try to reverse the economic downturn by economic stimulation. Latin America is in the reverse position right now. Their currencies are weak, and therefore they're dependent upon foreigners making loans, buying their products. And when they have an economic downturn, they're forced to raise interest rates to keep money in the country. And it's just the opposite. It's countercyclical of the way we deal with our economic problems. If Latin America can get together, they don't have to dollarize. But several countries have recently dollarized. El Salvador has, Ecuador has. In El Salvador, with the dollarization, you now can get 30-year mortgages, and interest rates are just the same as the United States. Panama has always been a dollarized economy. Whether they dollarize or create a uniform currency in Latin America among themselves, they will give themselves more discipline in their fiscal management, and B, the opportunity to stimulate their economies more when they have an economic downturn, instead of having to tighten the screws even more than they do now.
That's what's
behind this issue of currency.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else, a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Interesting that you just mentioned the Panama always being dollarized, but actually an interesting twist of history is that when the Panama Canal was being built, the blacks were paid in silver and everybody else was paid in gold. So there was
that is interesting.
A legacy of racial part of the racial history of the U.S. relation to Latin America. When you were announced to be on a while back, it was canceled, and subsequently you've resigned. I looked into this group that you were with, and it looked like it was absolutely underfunded, to my mind. It looked as shambolic as this African outreach agency that has not done anything at all except build interesting-looking offices in D.C. It hasn't done anything. It looks like it's a charade of development to me. I don't know if that had anything to do with your quitting, but it'd be interesting if you're going to talk about that at my prompting. But the other thing I wanted to say about the Alliance for Progress, the other legacy of the Kennedy era, is the officializing of the counterinsurgency program, which was the other part of so-called Alliance for Progress, has a legacy. That's when a lot of these dictatorial regimes started being installed. I mean, clearly the Eisenhower coup in Guatemala and leaving the Bay of Pigs attack on Cuba on the planning and in train when Kennedy took over was certainly set the stage for the counterinsurgency plans that led to the dirty wars and years of the generals, et cetera. But one can't hardly separate that. And on the economic level, the petrodollars and a lot of the money that was dumped into Latin America came with these structural adjustment programs. Those are exactly the kind of things that disallow the kind of Keynesian stimulation and all the sorts of things that you sort of suggested might be considered by the Southern Cone. I mean, it's just not possible with the kind of structural adjustment agreements unless you basically start playing hardball like Argentina is. I mean, they only came to it because of absolute duress. There's a lot there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're really very up on your Latin American history. The sequence is, though, let me sort of make some comments on what you brought up. The counterinsurgency, back in the 50s and 60s, this country was still engaged in war, what we call it the Cold War. But the efforts of the Soviet Union to penetrate the Western Hemisphere were quite active. What John Foster Dulles did in Guatemala, that was a precursor of U.S. intervention, but a variation of what had taken place before. The Bay of Pigs, the problems of dealing with communism. The country was just emerging from its McCarthyism period, and the scare of communism was still very, very great. And you're right, there were many policies at that time that we would not do today. The real issue with the dictators, though, came in the 70s. The overthrow of Allende in 73, I believe it was, around 72, 73, the Argentine dictatorships in 76, the real dictatorships in the black period in Latin America began in the 70s. There was a little precursor of that in Brazil was 64 when the president resigned and there was a threat of somebody from the far left taking over. U.S. policy has always been ambiguous in those things, but at that particular period, the concern that communism would spread in the hemisphere dominated the kind of thinking that you had with people like John Foster Dulles. And even right after with Kennedy and Castro. If you recall, the Alliance for Progress spoke about 1 minute to midnight, and that midnight was supposed to be when the communists would take over Latin America and expose the whole southern flank. So there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. But the real black period of Latin American history came in the 70s after the petrodollar influx came in. I don't think the petrodollars were really the cause of the counter-cyclical or the other kind of issues that arose in economic problems in Latin America. That particular period really flooded Latin America with so much money that a lot of corruption began to emerge, and I think it was the corruption and the lack of accountability during that period of the dictatorships that really set Latin America back a great deal. But all of those facts of how those facts interplayed are really quite intriguing, as you point out.
Is the caller still there? Did you want to follow up?
There's a lot of theory there, and of course, what I'd like to suggest is that prior to the Cold War, there was the fear of the Germans, and if you look at Smedley Butler's book, he's famously quoted as saying he was a gangster for capitalism and for the Brown Brothers Banking Organization. And there's a current guy who I suggest you should have on the radio, and that's John Perkins. He's got a book out called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which has been characterized as sort of the Smedley Butler expose of our time, in which he talks about a lot of places that he did these kind of structural adjustments, shakedowns, and fixed things, and particularly Ecuador actually was one of the places where he was working for oil companies. Mm-hmm. So I suggest that we could hear a lot of contemporary history stuff that you read about typically years later because he's finally done this expose. But the reason for your resigning and whether it had anything to do with my estimation of the outfit that you'd been working with or whether it was just too frustrating.
Well, that's an interesting point. You mentioned something about an African outfit. We're not related.
I understand. I was making a comparison to how inauthentic that
The organization was underfunded. There's no question about that. We had about $30 million a year. We put most of it into fellowships. We had the largest fellowship and training program for Latin Americans, and we felt that training that future generation, people who 5 to 10 years from now are going to be running things, making sure they get a better education, that was our top priority. That was not a reason I did not resign. My term was up as an elected position. It was 4 years, and after 4 years, the Secretary General Gaviria left, and I just did not want to continue in the bureaucracy, in part because we didn't have enough money to really make an impact. We made an impact in education. We created the Educational Portal of the Americas, which I would hope you would go to your website. It's educoas.org or educoea.org for the Latin American. We had 7 million hits a month coming in on that, and we had about 36,000 people that were taking distance learning courses from all over Latin America and getting better education at Penn State, Michigan, Harvard, et cetera. So we did a great deal. We created a lot of private-public sector partnerships. Microsoft contributed $6 million for helping to improve transparency and procurement in government and to build municipal portals and in education. There were a number of other companies that came in that contributed substantially. So we were able to use our limited government funds to build partnerships with private sector funds that were willing to exercise corporate social responsibility and contribute to the kind of programs we were dealing with in alleviating poverty and addressing the issues of poverty and education. So that was not a reason for my leaving. The underfunding, when you're underfunded, the idea is to look to the future and try to figure out how you do better in the future. Just my term was up and it was time to move on with the change of the guard at the OAS.
We have just about 7 or 8 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Ronald Scheman, recently stepped down as the Director General of the Inter-American Agency for Cooperation and Development. That's the development agency of the Organization of American States. He is the author of a number of books on inter-American affairs, including the recent book Greater America, A New Partnership for the Americas in the 21st Century. And it is published by the New York University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You did say a little bit earlier in the program that among the reasons that the United States really should care about what goes on in Latin America and what happens there matters to us are two real problems that we have to deal with that originate there. You said one, of course, being migration, illegal migration, and the other is the problem of illegal drugs. Should we be doing something different than we have done in the past in responding to those two challenges?
Yes, very definitely, David. Both of those relate to the standard of living in Latin America. as standard of living improves, as living conditions improve, the issue of migration will diminish, and the issue, and we'll be able to strengthen those forces in society that are willing to take on the drug mafias, as is happening in Colombia today, to be able to strengthen them to overcome the drug the drug lords. The key thing here, of course, is you get back to trade, because the markets in Latin America are too small to attract the kind of investment that was needed to create jobs. But only with economic development will both of these problems be overcome.
To kind of come us around to a sort of summary about what you think that the United States should be doing. Obviously, you mentioned a number of issues. The fact that you would advocate the kind of free trade approach for all of the Americas that we have taken towards the United States and Canada. You've talked about the fact that if we're in the United States going to come to energy independence, that we're going to have to look at all of the Americans as one large producing, consuming region, and that by working together, perhaps that's possible. You've also talked about needing to deal with basic sort of issues like poverty that we should be working to develop the countries, particularly those that where the economies are smaller and less developed. Are there some other things in terms of what it is in a very concrete sort of sense, what it is you think that the United States should be doing?
Well, I think the best thing that we could do, I mean, you summarized pretty well a lot of those points, and I appreciate that, but I would add education to it. Mm. I think if there's anything that we can do that is going to be relatively low cost, but can have the biggest impact, is to help strengthen the quality of education throughout the Americas, and to improve the workers' skills, and to improve their productivity, enable them to compete on global markets. Given the internet and given distance learning techniques, all of this is very young, but it really is a very promising area in bringing better quality teaching materials to teachers in remote areas, making opportunities available to young people, young professionals especially, that are in remote areas that now do have connectivity, and connectivity is increasing every day, opportunities for them to improve their professional skills and their ability to perform better on the job. The more that we do that, the more we help education in Latin America, the better the future for all the Americas will be.
One of the things that you mentioned is, as in your list of summary points, things that we should be doing, have to do with labor standards, and that you argue that we really ought to work to raise labor standards throughout the hemisphere. Now, this is the kind of thing that I think that when the whole debate was going on 10 years ago about NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, the point was raised then, and that people who were arguing in favor of NAFTA said, well, we have ways to do that. They're as attached to the agreement. There are mechanisms to try to ensure that people in Mexico, particularly, that's where the concern was, have the right to bargain collectively, that their rights are recognized, that we work for good working conditions. We don't want the working conditions there to be less than they are in the United States. There were also environmental concerns that were raised too. And I think that one of the objections that people had then and still have toward NAFTA is that that's something that actually hasn't really happened. Now, maybe you have a different perspective on that, but given what happened with NAFTA, I think that some people might be a little bit pessimistic about whether, in fact, we could do that, that is, elevate labor standards for all of the Americas based on our lack of success as far as Mexico is concerned.
Well, you state the complexity of the issue very well. I don't know of any other way to raise working standards except by improving the economic environment in which the factories and the other companies are working. If somebody has a better suggestion, I would be really interested to hear it. The key thing here is that in that these things take time. You follow U.S. history from the beginning of the 20th century or go back to Great Britain to Charles Dickens' time, and you see that this has been a concern and it's been a gradual evolution. I think we're progressing faster in Latin America than we did in the U.S. at the beginning of our century when we had our sweatshops and a lot of other things that were going on here. People talk about, oh, well, if we have free trade, it's going to be a race to the bottom, and that investing companies are going to invest where wages are the cheapest. It's a question of productivity. It's not wages. It's productivity. It's there are so many other costs, whether you can ship, whether your transportation costs, other things that are that relate to the cost of production. And I would say that if you had the free trade, you'd begin to improve all of those issues, and you'd be raising the bottom, not racing to the bottom. Our goal in free trade is to create the conditions where working conditions can improve, and I think it's the only way that we'll begin to really get working conditions to improve. There are adjustments that are going to be needed, not an easy task, but I don't know any other route to improving working conditions. And that's what many people seem to use as the main argument against free trade. Mm-hmm. I think it works just the other way around.
Well, there we'll have to stop with our thanks to our guest, Ronald Scheman. Again, the book, Greater America, A New Partnership for the Americas in the 21st Century, the publisher, New York University Press. Our guest, Ron Scheman, recently stepped down as the Director General of the Inter-American Agency for Cooperation and Development. And Mr. Scheman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much, David. You've been most stimulating, and it's been a great pleasure, and all your listeners have been great, too. So thanks a lot.
Very good. Well, programming here on AM 580, made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Also, the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Classes ongoing. You may join anytime. For more information, call 384-5829 or visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. Support also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 14 years providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Suggestions and requests always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio and the programming made possible by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. That's it for us. I want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the weather with meteorologist Paul Douglas. He's the author of the new book, Restless Sky.